the irony of brand building is businesses try to replicate things that work because they want to create a repeatable process. And the whole art of branding is if it's been done, then it won't work for you. It has to not have been done before.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Funnel Vision, where we're speaking with leaders in digital marketing who are making their mark on the industry. I'm Paola Mejia.
And I'm Sasha Belenke.
Let's get started.
So I am very excited about today's guest, Ari Yablok, head of brand at Island. I'll just start out by saying that Island, I think, is one of the startups to watch right now. They have completely reimagined enterprise cybersecurity. Ari, welcome to Funnel Vision.
Hey, guys.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here. Excited to talk about what I'm up to.
So we know that you've played a huge role in coming up with Island's brand identity, and we want to get into all that. But can you give us an introduction on who you are, what you do, what brought you there, to catch up our audience to all the great things you've been up to?
Absolutely. I am the head of brand for Island. I've been there for over 3.5 years already. And I joined because I actually came up with the name Island for the company. Before I was there, I had been working as head of brand messaging for a B2B tech branding agency in Tel Aviv called Atreo. Shout out to Carmel, the CEO there. And this naming project, among all the other messaging and narrative writing, end-to-end brand building that I was doing, naming, company naming, came up across my desk from time to time. And this company showed up and I was told, this is going to be the coolest thing you're going to do. And it was. And I was totally riveted, even after working with over 50 different startups across any industry you could think of, quantum computing and cyber and operation intelligence for surgeries and just crazy cool stuff. And this blew me away. And luckily I was able to come up with this name, which we could talk about, and thought to myself, if I could build a really meaningful brand from scratch, this would be it. And luckily they agreed. And I joined 9 months before we even exited Stealth to really build everything from scratch. And what Island is, just to give a quick overview, is it's an enterprise browser. Every single company, pretty much everyone is working online. And if they're working online, they're working on a browser. And if you think about all the different tools and elements of the tech stack that go into running an enterprise, and often we don't even see most of them, all of the identity and access and data protection and cybersecurity and productivity and all these different things, all of them are purpose-built for enterprise use. They have compliance and security and controls and all of that. And then there's this one thing that happens to be the center of the workspace, the place where all of that stuff is actually happening. And we all universally decided to use the free thing that you download, just like your teenage daughter does, or your grandmother, or anyone that is not yours. You are the product, right? Your data is the actual product. You can't call anyone if it doesn't work. There's no support system, right? There's no control. You have no access to any sort of manageability. It makes zero sense. But we worked that way because it was simply the easiest way to shift to an online workspace because it was already there. We were already there in our personal life. And the founders, Mike Fay and Dan Amiga of Island, came up with a profound yet stupidly simple idea, which is, what if we take that browser, flip it around to the back end, and build all of these tools into it so that you could control it from the inside instead of needing to spend millions of dollars tacking on all of these tools and solutions that are getting in the way of work, that are causing you to hire entire teams and set up server racks, rooms of servers in the back of your office just to get people to work on a browser? What if you just made that browser work for work? And every customer that they've spoken to pretty much was like, oh my God, of course. It was like, why hasn't this been around? This makes so much sense. And it was pretty clear early on that this was going to be a big deal. And what that meant for me was, how do we get the front, the storefront, the identity of this thing to properly represent the big deal that this is going to be? And that's how I entered the scene.
I love your description of it as profound and stupidly simple, because when I also first heard about Island, I was like, Like, why aren't we doing that? That is so obvious, but clearly it wasn't for a long time. And here you guys are. All right. I also want to quickly add, because you were too modest to add it to your own introduction, everyone should know that Ari also has his own really great podcast on branding in B2B marketing. So if you like this conversation, I encourage you all, after you've listened to Funnel Vision, to go and check out Ari's podcast, Believe in Brand.
So you just started describing this simple yet such an obviously needed product. And from a marketing perspective, my first thought is you're talking about not just building a brand from scratch, but creating a new category where you're at the same time educating your customer about what you're doing and educating them that there is such a possibility, right? It's like those infomercials. There's got to be a better way, but they're not even thinking that they have this pain point. So can you talk us through what is that like? What is it like to do that? What are the challenges and how have you done it so well? Because you really have done a great job at it. And I think doing it well is the hard part.
Yeah. And it's a great point because it really starts with realizing I'm not just marketing a product. And if I approach this by marketing a product to potential buyers, it will be dead on arrival. Like they'll be like, what are you even talking about? I don't understand the words coming out of your mouth. Right? And think about it for us. We're saying, hey, that browser that you already have that's free, what if you paid six figures for it instead, right? Like that's not something you could market. There has to be this.
That's element. Not your pitch.
Yeah, exactly. There's a few steps in between, but there has to be a reorienting of what are we trying to do before selling something or making a product appealing enough to buy in our customers' minds. And that really is what category design and category building is, which is it starts with education. Education that is fueled by storytelling. That is really what category building is. And it's not just marketing, by the way. It's really everyone in the company where I need to help you understand that the options that you have available to you right now are insufficient in some way, either because there is a problem that they are not fixing, and maybe you're not aware of it because you've never considered that there can be a solution, or that there is an opportunity, there's a gold mine in your backyard, and you're just walking around just sitting on a lawn chair on top of gold, and you could be just digging it up and enjoying a much better life if you just knew what was in front of you. So that's really what we needed to focus on. And it trickled down to lots of different decisions about how we communicated even early on, like our website. This is a Wix podcast, right? Our opening, our launch website was really very bare of calls to action and things to do. We really just wanted to help you understand why this thing needed to exist and why it should matter to you. And then if you were interested enough, you would call us and you would learn about it on a proactive level and not that we would be pulling you in. Because if you weren't ready to understand it, we weren't about to convince you. You needed to understand why it mattered to you first. So I think that education and that story-driven education is really that first piece that, again, marketers tend to, especially in early stage, when there's not a lot of money to go around, but there's also a obsessive need to get customers on board. It's very easy to say, I'll do that later. Let me just do the marketing playbook stuff that's going to get people to buy things. It's going to make every subsequent sale that much harder and that much heavier of a lift because you're going to have to build that education in every single time as opposed to setting the foundation for education in the beginning so that everyone who shows up each subsequent time will already know why they're here to begin with.
So I've made that mistake. I will be the first to admit that there have been times where as a marketer, I was under so much pressure, even pressure that I put on myself to bring in the leads, convert the SQL, whatever, MQL, and neglected the real selling process that marketing starts, which is a long and slow and many touch points approach. Then the question becomes, how do you do the education in the right way? You described obviously your site being a major focal point in how you were doing that, but I'm sure you were doing other things even in how you drove traffic to that or maybe events you were attending. What did that look like to start sparking that awareness in your potential customer's mind? Oh, there is such a thing as an enterprise browser, and this is how it could solve problems for me.
There is almost, it's an obvious step one in my mind because I've been doing this for years upon years now, but it has to start with a strategic positioning and a narrative built on it. What is the one thing that I need my potential audience to know that I do, that they are missing, and that no one else is providing them, right? That's the formula. And if it ends up just being a long list of capabilities and features and benefits, you didn't figure it out yet, even if you have a fully functioning product, right? Then you need to get that clear in your head. And then once you have that, it's, okay, how does that fit into my customer's world? Meaning I'm not just telling them there's this thing. I need to understand, okay, what's their world like right now? Why is it lacking in some way? And why are we the right people to deliver it or our company? And what does it mean for their future and really for the future of the industry, right? Even beyond them. That's an easy recipe for that's your story. That's how you start. Now, that's table stakes. In my mind, if you're not doing that, then you're succeeding despite not having that and not because of anything else. But the real intelligence here or the real next level stuff comes when you consider what those people that you're trying to get to are experiencing out there in the world, which is a tornado of sameness, right? Just an onslaught of everyone saying similar things in almost every single way. Everyone's features are more or less the same. Everyone's benefits are more or less the same. Everyone's websites are more or less the same. And I'm not here to tell you the answer is be different. I'm here to tell you to understand that. So that if your mindset is, let's tell them that our product changes everything, guess what? They just heard that from the next guy yesterday on a call, and they were pretty convinced by the end of that call that their product did not change everything. So they already have an opinion in their mind about what the words change everything means, and it's not good, right? It's not a solid one. So you can't use those words. So let me just try and boil it down to one thing. If you're trying to help educate on something new, there has to be signals laced into what you are saying and doing and how you are showing up that indicate this is new. And it can't just be saying, no, but really this is going to change everything.
But really we're different.
But we're the ones.
Yeah.
Right. So it's about, I can't use words that they already have associations with that are already overused. I have to literally build a different vocabulary. I can't use imagery or I can't evoke associations that they have already built in their mind that others are already using, even if our tendency is to build on what we know, to know what works. The irony of brand building is businesses try to replicate things that work because they want to create a repeatable process. And the whole art of branding is if it's been done, then it won't work for you. It has to not have been done before. So it's too
complicated.
There you go.
I have such a thing about copying. Just first of all, do your work. That's number one. And secondly, like, it doesn't help you. You just blend in. There's so much noise on whatever platform you're trying to engage your customer on. So if you can't find a way to stand out by doing things in your own way, you're dead on arrival. Like, it's just
right.
So I'm totally with you.
All right. I want to take you back a second. 3.5 years back, you're in stealth mode. What are you thinking about at that point in time coming into this really young company that has something that is potentially very disruptive, but at the same time, you're also going, you're a category creator, but you're still going into a space where you're playing with the likes of Google and Microsoft. That's pretty scary. So what is Ari in stealth mode thinking about at that point, developing this brand?
I'm thinking about one specific thing, and I remember it clearly. I had a goal in mind that I verbalized often when people were asking me inside the company, what are we going for here? And I said to them, we are trying to launch a company that will look 5 years old on day one. Mm. And the reason is somewhat obvious if you take a look inside. Like you said, we are asking enterprise executives to bet their careers on a technology that would be replacing or be compared to the biggest and most successful companies in the world who have built this for years and delivered this for years. And if we don't come off as equally viable and equally trustworthy and legitimate before you even see the product, then it's going to be nearly impossible to make the case that they should take this risk. Because ultimately, early on, anyone who's joining your cause as a customer, even as a design partner, is taking a risk. So that was my goal as a brand. I needed to basically obsess over how to exude market maturity, even when you are just hearing about us for the first time.
I think we talk so much about brand and trust in the abstract, And what you just did is you broke down the actual motivation of that enterprise's executive and why that trust is so necessary and what is like the meat of it. Exactly.
If I'm telling you there's a new thing you need to know about, right? And the same goes for that market maturity. If I'm showing up and my story is well thought out and my attention to detail is precise and deliberate, then you're going to say, oh, this probably isn't some beta product that still has a lot of bugs to be worked out. If they're thinking about all the details here, they must have thought about all the details back there when it comes to the tech.
So since you couldn't say this will change everything, what did you say? Give us an example. Like, how did you speak differently to that audience? How did you catch their attention in a way that's not just reusing, rehashing the same language that everyone uses and that is devoid of meaning at this point?
So my favorite example, and I've mentioned this on other podcasts as well, but it's just so important, the words. I'm biased because that's how I came up in this industry of being a brand messaging guy, but we initially launched as a product that was appealing to CISOs, to chief security officers. That is an incredibly saturated market where I cannot tell, like the vocabulary is so overused and so void of meaning because of how often you're seeing the same words that it was clear we weren't just going to show up and say more secure or
secure.
Yeah. Or just be ready for what's ahead. If you've gone to any of these cybersecurity trade shows, which we show up every year, it's fascinating to see that year after year, and they've all been there for years already. So they know what they're walking into. Every tagline, almost every tagline is secure tomorrow, secure for what's ahead, secure the future, right? I don't know if that means anything to me anymore. So we needed to, and this was my goal from very early on, we needed to create a new vocabulary and a new conversation around it. And to me, it was, and this goes back to what the word Island and the idea of Island represents, which is if work is in the place where it naturally belongs, then you don't need to secure it, right? So if you're walking on a 3-lane highway, you need security. You're at risk. If you're in your basement, in your man cave, watching TV, you do not need security. You're good. So we actually were appealing, we were trying to communicate to CISOs in a way that wasn't a security conversation, which is pretty counterintuitive, but it was the point. The point is you're spending all your time being sold products that are trying to get you to feel like you're in danger, and then so that you'll feel compelled to give them your money so that they could protect you, when we're saying, just take yourself out of danger, and we don't even need to have the danger conversation.
Yeah.
So we removed words like risk and threat and attack from our vocabulary. We are not talking about that. We even built that into our content strategy. When there's a vulnerability exposed that every one of our customers had to scramble to deal with, and we actually had a solution that protected our users, we did not write a blog about it, even though our engineers were like, guys, this is a big deal. We like solved a really big problem. We're like, no, we're not talking about it. Because that's not us. And we don't talk about risks and vulnerabilities and attacks. We talk about work being in its natural environment. We talk about productivity flowing. We talk about things being the way they should be. So those were the different angles that we were taking that were, again, hopefully sending signals of, oh, this is a different conversation. And it's scary because it also means they're not getting signals that they're used to automatically processing. Oh, okay, that fits into this line of budget, or that's a conversation that I know how to have with my CFO about going in on this product. No, they have to actually sit on it and think about it, and that takes more time.
That's a very interesting example because I could see it being very tempting to say, look at how we're like proving value, right? Look at how we protected you from this and this threat. That's a brave position to stand by so closely to your brand. But obviously, what you're doing is you're saying you don't need to worry about it because we're taking care of it for you. Me reminding you of all the things I'm protecting from is counterproductive. I want to touch on something that you've been hinting at, and I know you've talked about before, and it's brand as a business driver, and specifically how valuable or maybe even underrated brand can be in marketing teams. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've seen it over and over again on my feed and LinkedIn. I guess the algorithm really knows me well. How businesses have this like love-hate relationship with brand, where they don't see the reason to invest exorbitant amounts of money upfront into something that even the best brand marketer will tell you, I'm not really sure what's going to happen. So there's that tension of like, okay, so why do you need like hundreds of thousands of dollars that are just going to go float into the air? And at the same time, those same people a few years later will say, wow, we have been spending crazy amounts of money on paid marketing and on click, pay-per-click and all of that. And it's just not going anywhere. And our leads are just not really leads. They're just names of people. And all of this effort that everyone does, because that's what marketing is, maybe I could say it this way. The best way to sell tickets to a concert is if you're the Beatles.
Yeah.
Because if you're the Beatles, you don't really have to ask people if they want to come to your concert. They're not even going to go on sale, right? They're going to be sold out because there are people looking to find tickets to the Beatles or Taylor Swift, or, right? Let's just insert mega icon there, right? And that's really the kind of the holy grail of what marketing can do for a company, which is make this product and this offering so attractive to people that they are asking to buy it. It's a magic spell, right? And it's almost like beyond our imagination that we don't even optimize for that scenario. So we just keep trying to convince people who don't want to buy it. If you should buy it because of these three bullet points. I'm not listening, dude. I'm not. Because you just told me that you're going to secure the future. So I don't need that. So the idea of the long-term play, and everyone talks about the push and pull of the long-term marketing versus short-term, this quarter versus next year. I don't think there is such thing as choosing one over the other. You need to be available and a click away when someone wants it. But I really do think that the most impactful business decision you can make regarding marketing and regarding getting people to a place where they want to buy is putting in their minds the idea that this is something they want from their point of view so that they want to reach out to you and get it, right? You could call that inbound, right? That this is not a new idea, but if you just break it down as simply as that, it's unassailable. This is what any CEO would want to be happening. The waterfall effect, that suddenly everyone's asking for it. And that's what brand can do well on a few levels. Number one, being familiar, right? There was a time in our lives where the name Taylor Swift was like, oh, is that like teenager who plays country music? That's cute. And now it's, this is the most famous person on planet Earth, right? Who made $1 billion last year playing songs for the world. That's obviously, there's a good product there, but the brand of Taylor Swift, as an example, is what makes it so that everyone wants her. That's what you're trying to do. You're just translating that into a business context. It's not a popularity contest. It's about getting your story really and the affinity towards what you do and why you matter in the top of on top of people's minds and so solid and so clear that you don't need to convince them. You don't need to transact with them. It stops being a transaction. It starts being a relationship.
That completely resonates. I think, like you said, no one who hears that is going to say, oh, no, I don't want the Taylor Swift effect for my brand. I think where it gets really tricky is balancing, like you said, this quarter versus the long term, because you are going to have to be available for both and there are limited resources, budget, time, et cetera. When you're talking to marketing leaders or even for your own team, what time frames are you looking to see a return on your brand investment and what metrics? Because I do think, as opposed to a lot of what you hear is you can't attribute brand and that's why it doesn't get attention. But I think you can correlate effort to results. That's maybe not one-to-one, but we're smart here. If you see you did this and then this happened, you can deduce from that the impact. But I think that like experiment time frame probably varies from company to company, depending on how aggressive they're able to be on brand or not. And so do you have any guidelines for helping marketing leaders, brand leaders have those conversations with CMOs and CFOs who are like, this is great and I'm with you, but let's talk about how we're going to measure this and on what metrics?
Yeah, I have two different answers. One is the most obvious metrics for measuring brand impact or awareness, however you want to call it, is social engagement and web traffic, or branded search is a first cousin of that as well, right? Those are maybe your top three. Are people actually talking back to us when we talk to them? Are people showing up at our website to check us out? Are people searching for our name, which means they know about us and they know about us enough to want to know more about us? So if those numbers are going up, I think it's safe to say your brand efforts are succeeding, at least on some sort of timeline. The harder question, and I think this is why it gets muddier and on the business side, again, there's that tension, is the way I see brand working really well is if everything that everyone else is doing is becoming more effective. So it's actually their metrics, right? So if our paid ads are suddenly hitting new baselines, yeah, and if our newsletter is no longer 2% are opening, but now it's 5, and now it's 8, and now it's 12. Yes, it could be because the newsletter is getting better, and it should be getting better, but it's probably also because the people who are signing up, and hopefully the subscriber base is also growing, are seeing you more and more in the wild and liking what they're seeing, and then suddenly you showed up in their inbox for the 7th time, and they're like, oh, those guys, I like that. Let me see what they have to say in the newsletter. Brand did that. Brand did that. Not email marketing, brand. And it's not one or the other. And that's what makes this hard. It's muddy. It's cloudy. But the things that you're trying to do that are lifting, that's where brand is. And I do think there's a not so secret part of that, which is, and this has been actually on my podcast, an awesome marketer named Gary Service, who's a principal operator at Insight Partners, one of our big investors, just a genius in this space. He used this phrase, unlocking the TAM, which we've used that a lot internally at Island, which is on any given moment, whether it's 5% to 95 or whatever, there's only 5% of your actual market that's willing, that's in a position to buy what you're selling anyways. So any quarter-to-quarter efforts to bring in leads are only addressing 5%, because everyone else, even if they would love to buy, they're not even in a position. So you're not speaking to them. So if brand is doing a good job, it also means that suddenly that percentage is growing. There are more people at any given moment in your market that are like, huh, maybe I should consider that. Oh, I just saw something that was exactly what I'm trying to solve, and I didn't know that I'm trying to solve that, or I didn't realize that those guys can do what they do. Now I'm part of that 5%, and suddenly it's 10%. And if you're doing your paid ads for 10% of your TAM as opposed to 5, of course there's going to be a lift. The numbers don't lie. So that's the numbers game behind it, where if you just go to a CEO and say, hey, what if at any given point there was 50,000 more buyers willing to buy your product and we got 10% of those, you would want that, right? There is nothing else in this company that is addressing that problem besides for brand. So are you willing to invest now? Well, it seems like a no-brainer.
Super interesting. How do you execute this kind of in the day-to-day across marketing, where both a lot of people and also product have an impact on the way your brand is perceived and experienced? And even you're saying their metrics become your metrics. Are you having conversations with your head of performance and saying, listen, we're going to try this. Let me know if you see an impact like in a couple months. Is that how you're doing it?
Yeah, we are still early days, in my mind at least, even though I'm approaching 4 years at this. Like, the category building thing is just such a gradual process, because at any given moment, there's a cohort of people that know you really well, and then a whole lot of people that are still finding out about you for the first time. And in that sense, there needs to be this culture of constant experimentation in what's the thing that kind of gets their attention peaked and gets them to join the conversation. So that's the context needed for, okay, how are we talking about brand contributing? We're using it as, okay, what's that top of funnel or that kind of the awareness level? How are we tweaking that to get suddenly this rush of new activity or engagement, or to turn our field marketing efforts to that lead count that we get after it? The people that are showing up to that booth are going up by a certain percentage. Yeah, we are certainly having those conversations, but still in the context of experimentation, which means we're not necessarily shooting for a number, mm-hmm, or holding brand accountable for bringing in a certain amount the way marketing in general is held accountable.
You could do a great job convincing pretty much any founder of the importance of brand as a brand marketer is one of their first hires on the marketing side. I'm curious though, what do you tell the startup that didn't do that, is not seeing the results that they want, and now needs to course correct in terms of their brand? Like, what do you do if you didn't think about brand from the onset, and how do you fix it?
It's not necessarily a different process. It's more of a take a step back, do an assessment of why do we think this isn't working, or that this isn't getting the results we want, and what could be our new way into people's hearts. And you could call that a rebrand or a repositioning. I would maybe say more clearly, a rebrand sometimes just means like a new coat of paint, but not necessarily a new. So a repositioning is a business strategy course correct of, we are saying the wrong thing. We are not grabbing people's attention because it's blending into the noise, that type of thing. The hard part is, and maybe we could unpack your question for a second. The hard part is the mentality of not paying attention to brand is because maybe I don't appreciate it, or I don't understand what it's doing for me. And there's a bit of education or re-education that needs to happen in order to, because I could give you a scenario of what happens when you don't have that re-education. Okay, brand is a cooler website and a really good logo and maybe some kind of sexier language, right? It's not a big deal for the first couple of years. Oh, we're hitting a ceiling in our quarter-to-quarter MQLs or pipeline, whatever. Let's get brand in. What do we do? Throw a lot of money at an agency to give us a really sexy website, because that's what we'll do, a really much cooler brand. What that will do will be a good 4 business days of hype on LinkedIn, and that's on a good week, right? And then you're the same brand with a nicer storefront. And maybe there are some shallow buyers that are convinced by that there's something here, but that is not strategic. It is not solving the reason why you weren't thinking of brand to begin with. It's just throwing money at a problem, right? So the real answer is, what am I saying that's not getting through, and how do I say it better and more precisely and more deliberately? And that's the story side of it. And then the second is, and I'll say this to my grave, the brand is in the details. So it's not even the website or like those obvious deliverables. It's how we behave when you show up at a trade show, or the type of gifts we give. It's how much of what we're doing can tie back into this identity that we have and this message that we're trying to send, so that it's constantly reinforcing itself and building real estate in people's minds. That's the trick. And that requires a mindset shift, and then a very targeted pursuit of that goal afterwards.
So what does that look like for Island? I walk into a cybersecurity conference, everyone's booth looks pretty much the same. What am I seeing at Island?
I love this conversation. This was one of the first things we had to tackle, because our marketing strategy early on was going heavy on field, on conferences.
Yeah.
And by the way, that was because convincing someone on a website that they should buy a browser is really hard. Having a 3-minute conversation and showing them one feature had a 50% success rate of getting to a POC and a deal. Like, it was, yeah, it was, we're printing money if as long as we got 5 minutes face to face. So we're like, okay, paid ads don't make sense. Even anything digital doesn't make a lot of sense if people aren't really getting it. But the more we could show up face to face, the better. It wasn't that we abandoned digital. It was just, it wasn't effective. So we doubled down, tripled down on field marketing events. And in our minds, when we showed up, you needed to feel like you were somewhere else when you showed up to our booth. That was incredibly important. So every other booth, in especially a cybersecurity trade show, will have basically one of two experiences, which is very heavy on bullet points of features and benefits, very heavy on security messaging without necessarily recognizing that everyone else just did the same thing and used the same words, which is zero trust and AI and some combination of those two, right? Or the over-the-top gimmick, kind of eye candy type of booth, where it was a magician, a candy store, a 90s themed arcade, which I'm not knocking, because it yeah, F1 race car in the booth, Kawasaki motorcycle that we're going to give away at the end. All of these things, which are still used year after year, get a lot of eyeballs. But we needed to say, okay, we're not doing any of that. We want you to walk into an island world. And what we did is no messages. We're not going to talk to you. We're not going to make it so that if you walked by our booth and you read the walls, you could already decide whether to walk into the booth or to keep walking. I wanted you to walk by the booth and be intrigued by, oh, this looks interesting, but I don't know what it is yet, so that you would want to ask us. Because that's the whole reason why we're physically there, right? Otherwise, you're basically printing your website on your booth, and they don't need you there. So we got rid of walls. We doubled the size of the carpet. We added a scent diffuser and calming music. 2 years ago, we put a huge 16-foot dome with a natural scenes of nature with a narrator behind it that I scripted, and four comfy chairs for you to sit and just relax. And people were telling us, they walked in, I feel like I'm somewhere else, right? And it became a hangout. There was even a C-level executive that fell asleep in our booth for 15 minutes. And we didn't know whether to wake him or not, but he actually thanked us afterwards. And that was the idea. We wanted you, our core thematic element is like this place of Zen, right? If work is in the right place, then it's safe by design. And you don't need to think about you being in trouble. Every other booth was telling you're in deep trouble. You need to buy this. We're saying, no, you're good.
Holla, cancel the Wix Studio Magician. It's not working.
We would never do that. Actually, something that I'm really like in the world that you're describing, even not having been there physically. And I'm curious, did you have sales reps there or field marketing managers who were like actively approaching people? Or was it really a let this space pull people in and have them that ish generate the conversation? Because I think when you're doing events, you really think through all of these details, hopefully you do, as a brand, in order to make that experience just right, to set up the conversation just right. So I'm curious if it was just like creating the feeling of safety will pull in the right or start to have the right conversation.
Yeah, maybe I could call it a funnel, as we are on the Funnel Vision podcast. But the goal of the booth was we put three double-sided demo stations on each corner so that there were people getting demos of the actual product on both sides of these stations and basically every corner of the booth besides the backdrop. And what's cool is, and that was the point. The point was get a demo, also because on our website, you're not going to see our product so much. The only way to see it is if you're at a conference or you're calling us. And it was executive meetings, not on the showroom floor. Those two things proved to be very effective for us business-wise. And what we heard this year from the people at the reception for the conference, I'm talking about the RSA conference, the biggest cybersecurity show in America each year. Our co-founder, actually, Dan, showed up to get his badge. And they're like, oh, Island. I keep hearing this name. Everyone who shows up to get their badge is like, where's the Island booth? And oh, that's something you could attribute to brand. That's a pretty good measurable metric right there.
That's amazing. Yeah, count those.
Exactly.
So clearly, like, you thought about what the box is, and then you thought, what does it look like to be outside of it, which takes a really high level of creativity. Also, a very strategic outlook in how you do this. I'm curious, this is a big question, and I'm sure we can do an entirely different episode on just this. But like, what, as a brand marketer, what is that balance? Is there a perfect balance between strategy and creativity?
This has been on the top of my mind recently. Again, especially since what the company I work for is an enterprise software company selling to executives. These are not people who you have access to. They choose where their attention goes, and they have very little free time and attention. They're also some of the smartest people ever created on this earth. They are not going to laugh at a Bud Light commercial style experience and want to buy a product. That's not how their mind works. And they've seen it all and tried it all. That's why you don't even talk about creative. And I sound sacrilegious saying this. Don't talk about creative if you didn't do the strategy work yet. You're dead on arrival, like we've talked about a couple of times. You have a really cool, funny idea for a commercial, but you don't know how this is going to talk directly to your buyer and be so dialed into their world, especially in B2B, and talk in a way that you get exactly what they're going through and exactly what they need, and not in the way that others have talked about it, and it's not corny and tried already. You have to start with that thing. Who are we talking to, and what are we saying that's going to actually pierce their soul in a way the way other messages aren't? And you'll see a lot of creative out there that is trying too hard. Companies that have become very successful and realize they have money to spend and get a huge celebrity Super Bowl style commercial, but the script is just super canned and super generic and just fight threats. I don't know. It just doesn't inspire, and I hate to be just critical here. I'm not going to use names. Like, it's almost just the worst of creativity and strategy, because it's just over the top budget wise creative. Yeah. And there are very smart people that signed off on it thinking we need to be creative. And as long as we just say the words that we've been saying all along, or that they're used to hearing, we'll be fine.
Yeah.
I often am asked, what are examples of great creative? And I don't have a lot of them because it's just not done. So it's not done at a high level everywhere. It's pretty rare. And the rarity of it is not the creativity. There's lots of creativity everywhere. Is it strategic? Is it dialed in? Is it using a very specific language? Is it holding back as opposed to pouring it on, right? Is things like that where you're really thinking of it. And I'm going through this now. We are doing rapid creative cycles of what are some interesting ways to tell this story and put some investment behind it. And I have a doc of 30 different concepts that run the spectrum of there's nothing on the screen to there's a whole set and actors and all of that and everything in between, with the idea of, okay, but that's not exactly us, or, oh, but they're going to think a little bit differently about what we want them to think. And we're really dialing into every detail of it so that we get to this perfect sweet spot of it's us, it's them, and it's the one thing we want them to know.
Yeah, I think we talk so much about how you get people's attention, and then it's almost an afterthought of, once you have people's attention, what do you do with it? And how do you actually make that impactful? And how does that connect to your overall storytelling and every bit of your brand? So I guess there's no exact answer. It's a bit of both. But for the most part, people tend to value the creative and overlook the strategy.
Yeah, and I think it's because the strategy, those are both really hard things to do. But I actually think creative that's strategic is way harder than being just creative. And the strategy work is actually also the one thing that AI isn't necessarily going to be able to just hand to you. It really requires a deep knowledge of what you're doing and who you're talking to and all of those elements. So it's really almost like one of the final frontiers of, you need a smart human in the room that's looking at everything and saying, no, not that, not this, but let's hit these 28 different points. Can we hit them all in one, right? That's really what strategic creative is.
It sounds also like you think a lot about the psychology of these things and the sort of like behavioral economics behind it, and what does it actually take to move a person in the direction that you're trying to move them, which is really nice and refreshing to hear that perspective.
I think we even talked about it before, but I, in my bathroom is a few different behavioral economics books about that.
You didn't mention the bathroom part before.
I didn't mention the bathroom, but that's where your
that's
best
where the reading happens.
Done. Exactly.
Podcasts you can listen to anywhere, but the reading only happens in the bathroom.
It's true. Maybe that was a little TMI, but you get what I'm going for. Yeah, like the Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman. There's also another one with him and a couple of others called Noise. And obviously it touches on psychology, but the behavioral economics of it is, what shortcuts are people making all the time that they don't realize, which is another way of saying the word heuristics, right? Things we're doing mentally that we don't even realize we're doing that are actually the foundation of decision-making processes. And it's not about manipulating people. It's just about understanding why they would make a decision. And and a great example of that, and maybe connecting this to that creative conversation, is the thought that if I just tell them what this thing does, they'll want it, which isn't necessarily spoken by technology founders or by startup founders, but it is felt by them often, where they know how great the thing is that they're building. And in their mind, if they just tell it to you, you'll want it too, because you'll get it. That's a mistake in behavioral economics. That's, I don't understand the motivations behind why people make decisions. It's not something logically checks out, so I do desired action, right? No. If something appeals to a greater need, or if I understand the relevance of it in my life at this moment over the its appeal in general to the market, those are easy examples of like how you would change a creative approach to telling a story. And I could give you a good example. We're getting very dialed into our target buyer, which now is typically a CIO and their surrounding ecosystem or buying center in the company. CIOs tend to look around and see what other CIOs in their industry or even in other industries are doing. CIOs are also, over anything else, being asked to somehow boost productivity but lower costs, which often doesn't go together, but that's their job. And that means two things. Number one is they're often constantly feeling like, are others doing something that I didn't find out about and I need to find out about it? And I need to hear, I didn't hear, I missed the memo, a FOMO factor. And number two, a step improvement on the status quo is not going to solve their problem, because 5% more productive and 3% less expensive, I don't even know if anyone's seeing, right? Even if that's a lot of dollars, they're not. Their legacy is not being built by something that's slightly better version of what they're already doing. And the adoption and the change management of ripping out something and using a different alternative solution, that's a mess for them. The bigger the enterprise, the bigger the mess. So we are thinking about those two things very carefully. And we're saying, okay, our creative needs to produce a feeling of, wait, what was that? Like you missed out on it. Like other people know and I don't, which is not such a logical thing to do in something like a creative advertisement, where typically you want to just say what you're doing and make it look amazing. And we actually want to cut it off in the middle and make you wonder, wait, what was the rest of that? I didn't catch that. That's one thing. And the differentiation factor of how this is not just a step up, but this is a whole new approach, is that other factor where we have to build into the fact that this isn't going to just help. This is going to be your savior. And so just a little insight into how I'm thinking about behavioral economics and creative.
I think that is a great transition to our parting question, actually. Daniel Kahneman is the perfect transition. Before we let you go, we love to ask our guests three vital questions. Can you tell our listeners someone that they should follow, something to read, although we've covered a lot of options already, but if there's anything else, and something that people should be listening to? Where do you draw your inspiration as a marketer?
There are a few. I'm spending any free time in terms of learning. I have some audiobooks. I have a couple of podcasts and some people I really love following on LinkedIn. In terms of podcasts, there's a podcast called Marketing Against the Grain. I think they're just really good at capturing. Number one, they keep it short and sweet. They get to the point very quickly. And they're very good at surfacing something that feels very top of mind right now in the world of marketing. And diving right into it. So I'm not breaking any news here that's a good podcast to check out, but on the off chance that there are listeners that didn't hear about it, check it out. I'm trying to find someone who I was just having a conversation with yesterday so there's this guy on LinkedIn that I've just been studying his work, named Liam Maroney. He's a CEO of I believe an agency, a marketing agency called Storybook. And he's been tackling this issue of, we don't get awareness. We're measuring it wrong. We are thinking about it wrong. We're villainizing it or boxing it into something that it's not and focusing in all the wrong places. And he's doing it in a very thoughtful, long form way. So you feel like you're not just getting sound bites of hot takes, but really diving into why we're approaching that wrong. And you've heard a lot of what I had to say in this talk that touches on those conversations. I think he's a great one to follow. There's also a guy named Tom Goodwin, who's from the UK. He's like a major influencer on LinkedIn. But first of all, he's just straight up entertaining. He's like super cynical about where marketing is nowadays and how it all went to hell when we tried prioritizing metrics and leads over like getting through to people. And it's just important to balance out your feed with people that are just questioning what we think is real or not about our jobs. And I just like the big thought the big thinkers in our space just appeal to me a lot more. So
yeah, and I'll add a Believe in Brand to that. So like I said at the beginning of the show, anyone who enjoyed this conversation, I encourage you to check out Ari's pretty new podcast, right? The half a year about Believe in Brand for more insights into B2B brand marketing. I think there's so much to learn from you, Ari. Thank you so much for being on the show. That is it for this episode of Funnel Vision. You can find us on all of the major podcast platforms, and we'll be posting the full interview on YouTube under the Wix Studio page. Be sure to hit subscribe to stay up to date on our latest episode. You can also find more great resources for marketers at our content hub, linked below or in the show notes.